Chuck and Julie, bringing you the truth straight up.
I'm Julie Hayden. I'm working
an Emmy-winning former investigative reporter, a highly successful trial attorney, and publisher of a major Denver area newspaper. They've been partners as talk show hosts and in marriage as parents for over 10 years, providing thought-provoking information, opinion, and entertainment live, local, and interactive. Everyone's voice is always welcome on the Chuck and Julie Show.
Hello, everybody. Chuck Bonanno, Julie Hayden, Truth Straight Up, and boy, is that the truth for today.
That is indeed the truth straight up. Hey, the show brought to you today by AmericanCitizenPress.com, a great conservative website. I'm along with Dr. Julie McCallan from Denver Synergetics, as we joke, but it's only kind of half joking, keeping Chuck alive
for the moment.
She's a great doctor. Hey, a lot going on, as always, today. I'm coming up as soon as we get in. We're going to talk to John Eastman. He is a law professor, was one of Donald Trump's lawyers, was at the January 6th rally, was at the time working at a couple of different universities.
Chapman University.
Chapman and CU. And you can guess how well they took it that a conservative spoke at a Trump rally.
Can't have rallies.
Can't. You only have the First Amendment. It only applies for some people, not for
Black
other
lives
people.
Matters.
Right, exactly. Beyond that. I mean, this is in a world where Hunter Biden is teaching a course at a university, by the way. So they have a law professor who's not allowed to speak out or teach at a university, but Hunter Biden can teach at a university, Tulane University, about what fake media. It's like, there we go. Everyone wants their kid, you know, with Hunter Biden, rather. So, okay.
It'd be perfect. And the co-eds would be fully safe.
Oh, yeah. You know, and of course, you know, there are plenty of drugs to be had at college campuses. So that's a great deal.
And he can bring plenty of his own to the party.
Exactly. So. Coming up at 3:30, when we're done with John, we're going to be talking to, this is going to be a really interesting interview, Stephen Meyer. He's a philosopher of science. He's written a book called The Return of God Hypothesis, Three Scientific Discoveries That Reveal the Mind Behind the Universe. Basically, he says this is groundbreaking scientific evidence of the existence of God based on breakthroughs in physics, cosmology, and biology, which I think is pretty cool. But while we're waiting, John is coming in, but another thing we're going to need to talk about today, too, is the raid on Rudy Giuliani's house. Okay.
Excellent.
The federal government raised... because he might have been lobbying Ukraine. Okay. Yeah. Now, though, Hunter Biden is working for Burisma, an oil company Ukraine.
No lobbying there.
Joe Biden directly says he's going to withhold $1 billion in U.S. aid from Burisma or from Ukraine if they don't cancel the investigation. Joe Biden himself was indicted in Ukraine. And we're not even going to get into Eric Swalwell sleeping with Chinese spies. Those things, all okay.
Good.
All okay. But by God, Rudy Giuliani.
Giuliani going to the Ukraine. That has to be. You got to bring out the thugs.
The thugs on that.
So good. Well, luckily, we're joined by Professor John Eastman, or former Professor John Eastman, I guess I should say.
and find him in a Chinese server. Hey, John, can you hear us okay?
I can hear you fine. Let me see.
Perfect. Well, you're one of those guys, which you all need to do right now, and we so admire you, and we had a great
lunch. We should say that John has a significant portion of the state who greatly admires him and considers him a hero. And the other part of the state sees him as the incarnate of evil.
And you're no longer allowed to speak. So, John, why don't you explain what you've been doing in Colorado and what you were doing January 6th and how all of those kind of came together?
Well, yeah, or separated apart as a result. So I am the 2020-21 visiting scholar in conservative thought and policy at the Benson Center for the Study of Western Civilization at the University of Colorado Boulder. That's a mouthful. And I retain that title, though I have to acknowledge that right now I'm not allowed to do public speaking under the auspices of that title. So I am appearing with you on this program in my personal capacity and also as the founding director of the Claremont Institute's public interest law firm, the Center for Constitutional Jurisprudence. And I'm delighted to be with you. So on January 6th, well, it actually goes back a little before that. In early December, the president called and asked me to represent him in the Supreme Court of the United States. I did so via a motion to intervene and a brief in the Texas legal challenge the original action that had been brought against Georgia, Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania. Supreme Court refused to take the case. And then I represented the president in filing our own cert petitions to the Supreme Court in three different cases out of Pennsylvania, all of which the Supreme Court declined to take as well.
There we go.
I was in Washington, D.C. at the tremendously successful until some bad actors down the other end of the Capitol Mall intruded on the Capitol. Nearly a 500,000 people out front of the White House on the Ellipse on January 6th. And spoke right before the president. It was pretty heady experience speaking to 500,000 people on the Mall. I now know what Martin Luther King felt like back in in his march on Washington in 1963.
And so then what happened? I mean, the speech was good. At that time, I say you guys, including the president, had no idea what was going on elsewhere, right?
We did not. We've subsequently learned that Antifa was on their Twitter feed for several days, encouraging people to buy Make America Great Again MAGA gear and pretend they were Trump supporters and then cause as much violence and havoc as they could. There were also some white right-wing extreme groups that had planned to have an incursion into the Capitol on that day. They came well-armed and with flak jackets and what have you. But that was not the crowd that the president and I spoke to. And as the president made very clear, you need to march down to the Capitol patriotically and peacefully and let your voices be heard. This was a quintessential call to the exercise of our First Amendment freedom of speech and right to petition the government for redress of grievances, because people think something wonky went on with this election and we were not getting to the bottom of it. We weren't even allowed to talk about it.
Right.
What did you see in your incendiary remarks?
Well, and by the way, some of the top administrators at the University of Colorado said that my remarks caused people to go down to the Capitol. Now, just think about that. People came from all over the country, 500,000 strong, to hear the president of the United States speak. But I was so incendiary that they left before the president speak and went on down to the Capitol. I mean, it's laughable.
You talk about a social media influencer, John.
Yeah, exactly. But what I said was, look, we know for a fact that non-legislative election officials altered or ignored state election law. Why is that significant? Because Article 2 of the federal Constitution assigns to the legislature the plenary power to determine the manner of choosing electors. And so when these health officials or executive officials or county clerks were altering the election rules, they were changing the manner of choosing electors, and that was unconstitutional. Right. We don't know how big, we know that therefore opened the door for fraud. We didn't know at the time how much fraud passed through that open door. But what we're learning subsequent to that is that a significant enough amount of fraud did pass through that door to likely have affected the results of the election.
Before we get to your battle at CU, can you, because I think, you know, you're just great on this. Can you maybe briefly kind of outline what you mean by that? You know, when you say we saw the door was open, the stuff went through the door. Talk a little bit what you can about that.
So what I then said on January 6th was, we know, for example, that there was traditional fraud, dead people voting. And we had absolute sworn evidence from experts who had analyzed the voter rolls and not just against the Social Security Death Index, but against obituary tables and commercial databases, and said in Nevada, over 1,500 dead people voted. Similar evidence in Georgia and elsewhere. Non-citizens voting, people that had long moved out of state and registered to vote or got driver's license in other states voting. The traditional kind of fraud. But we also have seen evidence, and this is hotly contested. And of course, the maker of the Dominion voting machines has got multi-billion-dollar suits floating around for anybody even that talks about this. But the expert reports that have been filed in a number of cases, including most recently by the Michigan Attorney General's own expert, have acknowledged that these machines are susceptible to security breaches where bad actors can alter the results of the election if they can hack into the machine. And some of the experts saw that was happening on election eve on the Senate runoff on January 5th. I was at a war room in Washington, D.C. watching it happen. Wow. So those are the three things I said. It may be the case that there was reasonable explanation for everything that we saw. But I said, but there's also a nefarious explanation, and we don't know which it is. And until we get to the bottom of it, we can't have faith in the results of our election. And I said, our elected officials need to get to the bottom of it. And anybody that's not willing to do so doesn't deserve to be in office. That was the sum and substance of my 3 minutes of fame on the Mel Island.
Your rendition of 3 minutes makes me want to walk down to, or travel down to and burn the Capitol down. Just by itself.
Now be careful. That'll be used by the FBI as a
Okay,
so people need to read Irony, and
Chuck's sarcasm has gotten us in trouble before, John. So let me ask you, and let's clarify again, you weren't hired to speak, and you weren't working there for the progressive, liberal, radical, Marxist section or a segment of CU. You were hired to be with the Bruce Benson conservative. I mean, they knew you were conservative, right? It wasn't like they thought you were Ocasio-Cortez.
The invitation for application actually says seeking somebody with a high national profile in either the practice or scholarship of conservative thought and policy. I think I qualify. If I didn't before, I certainly do now. And what's most interesting, even before the controversy over the election, my original controversy with Colorado happened the week before I even showed up on campus. I'd been invited. I've been doing scholarship, one of the leading scholars in the country, on the original meaning of the Constitution's citizenship clause. Right. And I think the evidence is overwhelming that it meant not partial jurisdiction, territorial jurisdiction, or what we call geographic jurisdiction. If you're here, you got to comply with our law. But it meant something broader, that it meant allegiance-owing jurisdiction or complete jurisdiction. And that means, the children of citizens born on U.S. soil or the children of lawful permanent residents who have taken that step toward becoming members of our political community, their children are automatic citizens. But temporary visitors, what the drafters of the 14th Amendment said, sojourners, that they were just here as guests, and that didn't convey this automatic citizenship. So I was invited to apply that longstanding scholarship in the context of the newly named vice presidential candidate, Senator Kamala Harris. And I did, and I faithfully applied it. I said, I don't know whether her parents were here as lawful permanent residents and citizens or whether they were just as temporary sojourners. Were they on student visas, as appeared to be the case, since confirmed? And under the original understanding of the 14th Amendment, as I have faithfully articulated it for 20 years, then I don't think she was eligible for the office. So that, of course, created a huge controversy. But it was that topic that was the subject of my job talk when I was applying for the position long before Kamala Harris ever came on the scene. And yet they said I made it all up because I'm racist, because she's part Jamaican and part Indian. Knowing full well that I hadn't made it up in response to her, that it had been long in place. So the blatant lies, quite frankly, defamatory, libelous, slanderous lies that have been leveled against me is, by the way, why we're doing a news conference tomorrow at noon. And I should let people know where it is. I shouldn't let them know where it is. They need to go to Eventbrite and just search my name and then register to get the address. And that way we've got the required COVID contact tracing sheet of information.
There we go. Yep. Well, let me back up. And then after the January 6th, you were even in more trouble. And basically they've trampled your First Amendment rights. They said
And acknowledged to have done so. The first letter. So there was a demand letter from hundreds of members of the faculty and graduate students, ginned up, demanding that the chancellor fire me, remove me from my position. And he said, I can't do that. He was exercising his First Amendment rights. That would be unconstitutional. And then within a week, they had canceled my classes, falsely claiming it was because of low enrollment. But to this day, this semester, in the College of Arts and Sciences, which is where my classes were being held, Not labs and not, you know, externships or any of those things, but lectures and seminars. There are 120 classes with enrollments at or below mine, and none of them got canceled. So it's quite clear this was just a blatant lie, a pretext for taking an unconstitutional action. And then a week later, they suspended me with pay, to be sure, but suspended me from all of my other duties as the Benson Center visiting scholar. And again, you know, that's an adverse employment action. The fact that they continue to pay me doesn't mean that they didn't take an unconstitutional adverse employment action in retaliation for the exercise of my First Amendment rights.
And they cut off other resources to you at the law school and funds that you were supposed to have available.
That's right. They won't let me access the electronic legal databases that I need for my scholarship and research. They won't let me speak in the community using my title, which is part of my contractual duties. They won't let me use any Benson Center or university resources. So that's a suspension. It's a suspension with pay, but it's still a suspension. That's an adverse employment action, and they're not allowed to do that in retaliation for the exercise of your First Amendment rights.
But the Bruce Benson Center, who is supposed to be standing up for...
They
got behind you, right?
not remotely. And let me tell that part of the story, because the day the chancellor's global community-wide, even to alumni and even to the media, a scurrilous defamatory statement about me was sent out saying I had no evidence and therefore what I did on January 6th was repugnant. I sent a note to the head of the Benson Center, under whose auspices my visitorship is being held. And I said, I want you to know I have sworn testimony or expert reports to support every statement I made. And that was on Thursday afternoon, January 7th, on Saturday, January 9th, he sent out a campus-wide newsletter to the Benson Center newsletter list. Said, "What I find what most irresponsible about what Eastman did is that he had produced no evidence for anything he said." So he knew it was a lie, which, you know, in legal terms means that he did it deliberately, that defamation, that false statement was willful and therefore rises to the level of malice necessary to prevail in a defamation suit, even if somebody like me is a public figure in the controversy.
So you're fighting back.
We're going to announce tomorrow. We're not going to give too much here, but people should show up at the news conference tomorrow at noon. I'll put in the chat room there the Evite URL so they can go on and get the details of that. Ought to show up and hear what the next steps are.
And then otherwise, and let me clarify too, so the folks who aren't watching us on Zoom, if anybody listening wants to go to Eventbrite, people know that's the event thing. And then if they just search your name, John Eastman, EASTMAN, the invite will come up there too as well, right?
Yes, indeed.
Yep. And that's at noon.
Well, let's talk about the island of conservative thought at Boulder. You know, there is the
free thinking,
which is supposed to be the Benson Center. The Benson Center is supposed to kind of weigh, add a half pound to the ton and a half of liberal bias for the university. But talk a second about the first head of the Benson Center and what he views as.
The first director of the Benson Center, Robert Pasnow, was quoted in the Denver Post in one of the articles responding to me. They sold a lot of newspapers, by the way. They had me in the opinion pages and the news stories and the letters almost every day for a month. But he was quoted as saying, you know, the Eastman is, you know, just proof why conservatives shouldn't be in higher education because they don't believe in facts and evidence. Now, Professor Pasnow never reached out to me to ask me for, you know, what evidence that I have to support this. Dan Jacobson, the current director of the center, after I had told him I had the evidence, didn't bother to ask me for it. Chancellor DeStefano never asked me, never met with me, never talked to me to ask whether I had any evidence. The dean of the law school sent out a scurrilous defamatory letter without ever bothering to talk. And I, by the way, I've offered both on this issue and on the on the citizenship issue back last summer to have a public forum to discuss these things. And I'm happy to entertain the possibility that somebody might prove me wrong.
Right.
But nobody wants to even talk about it.
Well,
and that, at a university, we're supposed to look at this stuff to get to the truth. And they don't even want to talk about it.
But what I love is the fact that the head of the Benson Center, the original one, thinks that there's no reason to have conservatives on campus. That's an interesting choice. And he opposed it, didn't he? It's original.
Well, that's what I've been told. I've not independently verified that, but that's what I've been told. And if you oppose it and then you maneuver to become the director to try and minimize its impact. Yeah. Now, by the way, let me just talk about it. I mean, if the point of having the Benson Center is to give the students of the university an opportunity to hear alternative viewpoints and learn to think for themselves and make judgments for themselves. Here we had one of the most significant news stories of a decade, international moment with an insider here on campus. I mean, how much of a better opportunity for the Benson Center to spread its wings and say, here's what we're here for,
right?
To let you hear from this, and let's bring other experts in that think he's full of hot water. And in that crucible of academic debate, serious scholarly exchange, will be more likely to get to the truth. But no, they just immediately jumped on the bandwagon of trying to shut up any conversation about it. And I think that's a terrible miss opportunity for the students, and so sad that a university that purports to support academic freedom, intellectual curiosity, has gone overboard to shut down any voice that is counter to the overwhelming status quo on campus.
I have a couple of questions on that, but first, Randy Corbin is texting me. He said nothing comes up in an Eventbrite search yet. It should, though, right?
It should.
Okay.
Randy. Oh, you know what? Okay, because I had not. I had made people use the link. I have to open it to public. I guess I can. Yeah.
Open it to the public. There we go.
Live time. That's what you get with live radio.
That's right.
Exactly.
If you got a question, we will fix it here for you at the Chuck and Julie Show with John Eastman. Thank you to Randy. So let us know if it's a problem. Well, let me ask you: when you're done fixing that? You know, you've been involved in academics. You've been involved in the public stage for a long time. What do you think? I mean, can you even imagine, or in your wildest dreams, you know, 6 years ago, would you have even imagined that this would be happening, that we would be at this place where anyone who does not spout the company line is not just poo-pooed, is not just debated, but is silent, shut down, shunned? I mean, would you even imagine this could be happening in America?
No. I mean, you know, we've got one of the most robust protections of freedom of speech in the world. And yet we're throwing it away. And why is that so important? Because, you know, nobody has all the answers. We've learned that a long time ago. I had an old professor of mine after the Kent State tragedy back in the 1960s, and campuses were closing all over the country, and he kept his classes open. And somebody said, "What would it take you to close the classes?" And he said, "When we have figured out the answers to all the important questions." And those that think they already have all the answers have already failed that test, or I'm doing a bad job on his quote. But it's important to always engage in the inquiry, because it's never going to be the case that we have the answers to all the important questions. And the way we get at the answers and the truth to the important questions is by deliberation and by exchange of ideas. And when you accept it as truth gospel, that you already have the answers on something as controversial as this election, for example, the possibility of ever getting to the truth is slim to none. And yet all too often, all too many of our major institutions, our universities, our major media, our political parties on both sides of the partisan aisle didn't want to hear any of this. And if it's true, look, I mean, right back to one of the founding principles in the Declaration of Independence, the legitimacy of government is based on the consent of the governed. We exercise that consent every 4 years in a presidential election by determining the direction of our government. If we no longer have the ability to do that through elections, we no longer are governing, are controlling as the sovereign people the direction of our government. And
well,
that's a very sad state of affairs.
Well, that's what they're after, I submit. That's what they want, right?
Yeah, exactly.
What hope do you have that the Maricopa audit, assuming it goes forward, will be able to produce evidence of fraud?
Well, I have a great deal of hope, and I think the other side had a great deal of fear, because you can see what's happening. I mean, why is it now the end of April and we're just beginning this audit that the legislature started issuing subpoenas to try and do way back in December? I mean, the Maricopa County Board of Supervisors has been fighting tooth and nail to prevent this audit from occurring. And then even after the courts ordered enforcement of the subpoenas, they were dragging their feet. And then they wouldn't let them look at the subpoenas where they are housed in Maricopa County, creating now what's becoming this false narrative that, well, now they're no longer secure. So any results of the audit won't be valid. You might have lost ballots in the transfer from the Maricopa County headquarters to the convention center. And ongoing efforts by a team of lawyers, reportedly 70 lawyers by Perkins Coie, sent down to Arizona to do everything they can to thwart the audit. Now, I said way back in early December, if I were Joe Biden and believed that I had won the election fairly and squarely, I would be the first one out there demanding a full, transparent, comprehensive audit in all of the swing states to gain the legitimacy that at the moment, with 50 million or more people wondering what happened in the election, that you don't have. And the fact that he and his minions are doing everything they can to prevent that full disclosure suggests to me it's just a big red flag. Maybe there's nothing there. Maybe they just think we're a bunch of hicks and really don't know what we're talking about and don't want to give us the time of day. But they are spending millions in legal fees and efforts and threatening people even for raising questions, threatening to disbar lawyers who are representing people in these litigations to try and shut down any discussion about it. And that just doesn't happen if there's not something to hide.
That's right.
but luckily, the chairman of the Republican Party here in Colorado assured us that we have the gold standard of voting right here in our.
Well, I'm not sure what they mean by that. If what they mean by that is the gold standard and having no excuse absentee balloting, that the Carter Commission, the Jimmy Carter, Jim Baker Commission said was the place where most fraud can occur. If the gold standard is putting those ballots out there, by the way, mailing ballots to dead people and people that no longer live here so that they can be abused and fraudulently voted, and making it difficult to actually catch the fraud after the horse is out of the barn, right? If that's what he means by the gold standard, then I guess we have it. But I don't think that's normally what the American people who want integrity in the elections means by it.
But here's the hard thing, and that's the chairman of the Republican Party. That's not the chairman of the Democratic Party. And Maricopa County has all Republicans except one Democrat on its board. So what goes?
Well, let me be clear. We do have a two-party system in this country. There's the establishment inside Washington, Beltway establishment crowd, Republicans as well as Democrats. And then there are us out here in flyover country that, that they all look on like New Yorkers look on the rest of the country, you know, the kind of Hicksville. But the fact of the matter is we, the people, are supposed to be the ultimate sovereign. They're not supposed to be cutting deals in back rooms, whether it's $2.5 trillion unconstitutional infrastructure deals or $1.9 trillion COVID relief bills that is not giving COVID relief. And yet both establishment wings of the two parties seem more in line with each other on those things than they are with us, the American people.
Well, yeah. Randy has just emailed Julie saying or texted her to remind me that's the former chairman
of the Republican
our new
Party.
Chairman of the Republican Party elected a month ago is not the progenitor of that thing.
Which is a good point to make. Well, hey, John, just a final question for you then, because I know you have a very busy day ahead of the news conference tomorrow. What if, for people listening here today, what and I know this is sort of a softball philosophical question, but I think it's important. What are some just a couple of main takeaways that you want people to take away from all of this?
Well, the integrity of our elections is critical for vindicating the principle of consent of the governed. And whether the election was stolen or just appears to have been stolen, we need to have a full assessment. Otherwise, we can no longer have faith in the integrity of our elections. That's takeaway number one. That's looking backward. Looking forward, we've got to make sure these kind of chaos by design implementation strategies do not succeed in any election ever again. Because our faith in the electoral system is too critical as a necessary step in our faith in our government. So looking backward, we got to get to the bottom of what went on. And if the election was not stolen, we have to know that so that the Trump supporters can at least reconcile themselves to the fact that they lost. If it was stolen, it's important we know that as well, so that we know that the current operation is not a legitimate one and ought not to be governing in the most aggressive leftist agenda we've ever seen. But more importantly, looking forward, we now have to know how it was done so that we've got multiple sets of eyes on every step in the process for the next election to make sure that it never happens again. And then we got to clean up our voter rolls. We've got to fix our election laws in the places where the changes were actually done legally and not illegally to minimize the risk of fraud. I mean, there's nothing wrong with having a voter ID, for example.
Well, that's what Sandra was wondering.
Yeah.
You've got to have a voter ID to go to the Democrat national headquarters, for God's sakes. You got to have a voter ID to rent. Do we still have Blockbuster to rent a video at Blockbuster, or have we gone beyond that? There is nobody in this country. And by the way, to claim that it's racist to insist on voter ID is about the most patronizing racist statement I've ever seen. The notion that African Americans are not capable of getting voter ID is what that claim means. That's just a racist absurdity. And a large number of African Americans have had it up to here. This is why President Trump received the highest percentage of African Americans and Hispanic Americans of Republicans ever since the civil rights era. And by the way, I never know why we lost the support of African Americans, the party of Lincoln, the party that of emancipation. Right. But again, false narratives have told a wonderfully bad story.
Yeah, well, I can tell you, so I lived in Mexico for a while. And what their elections are like, even though they have a tradition of being fraudulent, they changed that. Now you go there, it's not only do you have to present an ID, they have your picture next to your name. So when you pop up, they compare your picture to it. And the idea that in Mexico, that's just Jim Dandy, but just to have a voter ID is somehow racist against Hispanics from Mexico is truly amazing.
Well, and it seems to me it needs to be an ID that has a picture, so that somebody just hasn't used an ID. And it's got to be an ID that reflects your domicile, where your legal residence is. So in Colorado, we have a residency requirement in order to vote, right? And specifically in the statute, it says if you're only here in Colorado because you're attending college here, that doesn't make you a voter eligible resident. Right. And yet when you go to the polls, you know, one of the IDs they allow you to use to prove your residency is your buff card at the University of Colorado, which doesn't prove that you're a resident.
No.
I mean, just proves you're a student at the university. So these are the kind of things that if we're serious about faithfully allowing only eligible voters to vote and not allowing fraudulent voters or ineligible voters to vote, these are the kind of things that we have to fix.
All right, John, people love you. If you can see that, they love you, our listeners. So, thank you so much. Everybody,
thanks for coming on, and we'll be there.
All right, we'll see you tomorrow. By the way, it's not the original address I told you, so check the latest update, but we've got a new location.
All right.
Very good.
Thank you very much, sir. And reminding everybody, you can just go to Eventbrite and search his name, John Eastman. That's JohnEastman. And you can find the link to either go to the news conference if you want, or to you can join it. I think they're going to be live streaming it. So
We're still working on that. Hopefully we'll be able to do that.
All right. So I could be there with my cell phone and we'll put it on.
We may put you in charge of it. Very good. All right. Thank you.
Thank you, John. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
John. Hey, want to switch gears. Thank you very much to him. And I want to switch gears and talk to author Stephen Meyer. He is a philosopher of science, has a new book out, The Return of the God Hypothesis, Three Scientific Discoveries That Reveal the Mind Behind the Universe, presenting groundbreaking scientific evidence of the existence of God based on breakthroughs in physics, cosmology, and biology. Sir, thank you very much for joining us, Stephen Meyer. Can you hear us okay? Everything okay?
I can absolutely hear you. It's a delight to be with you. Thank you for having me.
You too. So is there a God or isn't there a God? How about that?
Well, I believe there is a God, and I think the evidence points strongly to the existence and reality of such a being.
Okay. I do also, but let me have you
watch. I'll give you my view, which is I was brought up in a church in which all the associate pastors and others were former science professors, mathematics professors, teachers, and they'd all quit the profession and gone into the seminary because their lives were profoundly unhappy. And they found that a belief, in their case, belief in Jesus, made their lives happy and fulfilled. Believing there's a benevolent God, a God who cares about you ultimately, it allows one to have a happy life. So when they're teaching us, and we always had the kid from the atheist family there, of course, whose parents maybe just dropped him off as daycare, they go, we don't care if you want to believe in God. Make yourself miserable. You know, whether you'll be absolutely able to prove it or disprove it is highly unlikely. Some work in quantum mechanics, and it's, if you think you understand the world, you don't. Super string theory hadn't come up yet, but that imagines 11 dimensions, not three or four. So the idea that we have the slightest idea how this universe really is or really isn't, it's like Einstein said, you know, you find a seashell on the shore and you think you know all about the oceans, and we don't.
Well, I can tell you that many of those professors who left their profession to pursue ministry were not leaving because they were unhappy doing science. If we think of science as a form of inquiry, investigating evidence, they were probably unhappy in the profession because there is because of the sociology of science, the dominant view in among many scientists from the late 19th century forward has been tending towards atheistic or agnosticism. The technical term in philosophy is that they hold a worldview known as materialism or scientific materialism. It says that matter and energy are the primary realities, that they've been here from eternity past, and that they have arranged themselves by undirected natural forces to produce everything we see. It's kind of a default narrative or philosophy that undergirds a lot of modern science. Or in the culture and sociology of science, but it's not supported by the evidence, and that is the argument of my new book, that there have been three major discoveries, among others, that point to the reality of, first, an intelligent agent, a designing intelligence responsible for life in the universe, and secondly, to an intelligent agent who has the attribute that traditional Jews and Christians and other classical theists have long ascribed to God, namely that the intelligence responsible for life in the universe must transcend the universe. It must be in some way separate from it, but also active in it. And we see evidence of both of those things in physics, cosmology, and biology.
Can you walk us through? I mean, I know it's a huge book, which everybody should get their hands on and read.
Absolutely. I mean, that's kind of the fun of the story. Late 19th century, we inherit this view called scientific materialism. Figures like Marx and Darwin and later Freud, Huxley, are responsible for formulating this kind of comprehensive naturalistic worldview allegedly based on science. But then in the 1920s, we get the first hint of that maybe the death of God was premature, to paraphrase Mark Twain. And that first hint of that comes in the field of cosmology and astrophysics, when the astrophysicists, the astronomers, begin to notice that the light coming from very distant objects in the night sky, which they later determined were galaxies, that this light was being shifted towards the red end of the ultraviolet spectrum. Now, red light in the visible spectrum has a longer wavelength. So, in effect, what they were discovering was that the objects in the night sky were moving away from us, and the wavelengths of light were being stretched out as a consequence. And as they surveyed the different quadrants of the night sky over the ensuing several decades, this pattern just emerged over and over again, and it gave us a picture of a universe which was expanding outward in the forward direction of time. Now, if much like a balloon, as you blow it up, if you back extrapolate, if you wind the clock backwards in your mind's eye, it then suggests that at every point in the past, the matter of the universe would have been more and more densely concentrated, more and more closely compacted together, until finally you reach a point where it's all compressed. And that marks the beginning of the expansion of the universe, and arguably the beginning of the universe. That was just one of several discoveries in observational astronomy that suggested a beginning. Another, called the cosmic background radiation, was discovered in the 1960s. But then on a parallel track, there were developments in theoretical physics based largely on Einstein's theory of gravity, known as general relativity. Einstein's view of gravity suggested that space and time were connected, and also that matter or massive bodies actually bent space. They cause a curvature in the fabric of space or space-time. And that implied, again, as you're moving backwards in time, as that matter is getting more densely concentrated in the reverse direction of time, space would be more tightly curved until, as Stephen Hawking showed in the 1960s, you eventually reach a limiting case where the curvature of space becomes infinitely tightly curved, corresponding to zero spatial volume and marking the beginning of the universe, where you have literally a picture of everything coming out of nothing in an instant of time.
So there was a beginning. Okay.
There was a definite beginning, exactly. And so the challenge there is to the materialist view, because if matter and energy, space and time, are coming into existence a finite time ago, you can't invoke prior physics to explain the origin of the universe, because there was no physics. You can't explain the origin of the universe by reference to matter, because it's matter that comes into existence at the beginning of the universe, before which there was no matter to do the causing. So this discovery presents a profound challenge to a materialistic worldview. And after all, staunch materialists or scientific naturalists like Carl Sagan and Neil deGrasse Tyson have long said that the universe is all there is and all there ever was and all there ever will be, to quote the mantra from the Cosmos programs. But we now know that the universe has not always been here, and it had a definite beginning. And this is directly contradictory to the expectations of scientific materialism as a worldview, but it's exactly what you would expect on a theistic view. In fact, the great physicist Arno Penzias, who discovered the cosmic background radiation, said that the data we have from astrophysics are exactly what I would have expected if I had nothing to go on but the first five books of Moses, the Psalms, and the Bible as a whole.
And didn't Einstein say his cosmological constant, which was his way of cheating from his own general relativity, was the greatest scientific mistake of his life?
Exactly. He called it the greatest blunder of his life. What he did is he understood that his notion of gravity implied that if gravitational force of the kind, as he was conceiving it, was the only force acting in the universe, then we ought to by now live in a great black hole, because all the matter would have condensed into a dense sphere of matter, I guess, if you will, which would have caused space to curve tight more and more tightly. And so we should live in a universe that's already crunched on itself and has no empty space. But in fact, we live in a universe with empty space. So there must be an outward pushing anti-gravity force, which he called the cosmological constant. And that implied a dynamic, expanding universe from a beginning. But to get around that implication, he fixed the value of the cosmological constant arbitrarily with no evidence. He just gerrymandered it, if you will. Yeah, you guys are just talking about voter issues. So, yeah, there was a little bit of gerrymandering in the physics. And so that the outward pushing force of the cosmological constant would exactly balance the inward pulling force of gravity. And that seemed plausible for a while, until other theoretical physicists showed that that was not actually, even then, that would not create a stable universe. Very slight perturbations or changes in the configuration of matter and energy anywhere in the universe would cause either an expansion or a contraction, and push it from static to dynamic. But then there was also the evidence of the red shift. In my book, I say the heavens talked back to Einstein and said, you've got this wrong. The universe is actually expanding. And the great Belgian physicist and priest, Father LaMatra, told Einstein about this redshift evidence in a taxi cab ride on the way to a famous physics conference in 1927 in Belgium. And then Einstein later went out to the Mount Wilson Observatory and met with Edwin Hubble, the great observational astronomer who had discovered the redshift, and came out and met with the press. And 2 weeks later, he gave an interview in the New York Times and said that Hubble and Humason, his colleague, had firmly established that the universe was expanding. It wasn't static. It had a beginning. And later he did say, just as you said, Chuck, that that this was the greatest blunder of his scientific career, to not allow the evidence to determine the outcome, but rather he had some philosophical presuppositions. He didn't like the beginning, and he said he didn't like it because he thought it reflected ideas from Christian theology.
Well, there are great scientists, including Fred Hoyle, who was the guy who really came up with the life of a star back in the 1930s, but was a Marxist. And he just couldn't stand the Big Bang because it was too close to Genesis. And so for his entire life, I think he lived until the 1950s, he refused to believe it. It didn't matter how much. At least Einstein could kind of go,
maybe.
But Fred Hoyle, who by every indication was a brilliant man, refused. Just said, no, there is climate change.
There is climate change. What about DNA?
Hoyle's story is a very interesting one, and I tell quite a bit of it in my book. He lived longer than the 50s. I met him and had quite a long conversation with him when I was a first or second year grad student in Cambridge. He came and gave a talk there, and we ended up talking about the evidence for design and DNA, which by that time in his career, he was actually kind of a proto-theist, but he started out as a staunch atheist. You're absolutely right. And he gave the Big Bang theory its name, thinking that the Big Bang was a kind of pejorative. He was making fun of the idea. And, of course, it caught on, and now that's the name by which astronomers refer to it. So he held to the opposite view, the so-called steady state view, and never actually gave that up.
No.
But he did have a major shift in his worldview because of something else he discovered in science, and that is that in order to account for the abundance of carbon in the universe and other large molecules like oxygen that are necessary to life, he discovered that there were a whole host of what are called fine-tuning parameters, things that have to be just right against all odds to make it possible for life to exist. For example, the exact strength of that cosmological constant, if it's pushing, the outward pushing force were a bit stronger or a bit weaker by an accepted value now, is 1 part in 10 to the 90th power. You can't even get your mind around the degree of precision that represents. Then life would be impossible. Or in Hoyle's case, he discovered that the gravitational force had to be exactly right within very fine tolerances, and many, many other factors, the masses of quarks, the elementary particles, etc. So we live in what many physicists now call a kind of Goldilocks universe, where things are not too strong, the forces are not too strong or too weak, the masses of the elementary particles, not too heavy, not too small, or not too heavy, not too light, the speed of light and other parameters, not too fast, not too slow, everything within very precise tolerances. And there doesn't seem to be any underlying physical reason or logical reason that these physical parameters have to have exactly the strengths or values they do, and yet they have to have these precise values if life is to exist. And Hoyle, reflecting on this evidence of fine-tuning, said that he thought that a common-sense interpretation suggests that a super-intellect has monkeyed with physics and chemistry and that there are no blind forces in nature worth speaking about. In other words, fine-tuning suggests a fine-tuner. And so by the end of his career, he had shifted from a staunch atheist to someone who had very strong theistic leanings. He thought there was evidence of design in the fundamental parameters of physics, and he was sympathetic to the idea that life also was pointing to a designing intelligence of some kind, based on some famous probability calculations he made about the improbability of generating even a simple protein in the known history of the universe.
And so the materialistic side has come up with a answer to that. You want to explain that?
The contrary hypothesis is not that there was a single transcendent intelligence responsible for the fine-tuning, the improbable fine-tuning, but rather there is a multiplicity of universes out there, a gabillion others. That's not a technical mathematical term, but you get the idea. Lots and lots and lots. So many, in fact, that one with the right set of parameters would have had to have arisen somewhere by chance alone, and we just happen to be in that lucky universe. That's the multiverse hypothesis. But there are two problems with that.
Okay.
The first is that if all we have are these other causally disconnected universes, universes that are not interacting with ours, then their existence does not actually affect the probabilities of anything in our universe, including whatever it was that set the fine-tuning. And therefore, in order to portray our universe as a kind of lucky winner of a giant cosmic lottery, the multiverse proponents have realized that they need to provide some sort of underlying causal mechanism, a universe-generating mechanism that can function as a kind of common cause of all the universes that they postulate might exist, so that they can portray our universe as the lucky winner of a random process that has some underlying mechanism driving it. So that's the first problem, and they have addressed that by proposing universe-generating mechanisms, some based on, as you mentioned, string theory, and others based on something called inflationary cosmology. The problem for the multiverse proponent is that even in theory, these universe-generating mechanisms will generate new universes if and only if they are themselves exquisitely finely tuned. In other words, the multiverse hypothesis posits prior unexplained fine-tuning and doesn't explain the ultimate origin of that fine-tuning. So the fine-tuning is not actually explained away by the multiverse, and yet we do know of an explanation for finely tuned systems. When we talk about fine-tuning, that's just a shorthand for something that is a set of improbable parameters that jointly function to achieve a functional outcome or exemplify a set of functional requirements. A French recipe is finely tuned. An internal combustion engine is finely tuned. A radio dial is finely tuned. But all of these are finely tuned by intelligent agents. And therefore, intelligent design is the only explanation we have for finely tuned systems. Since the multiverse doesn't provide an alternative explanation, intelligent design stands as the best explanation of the fine-tuning of the universe.
And why don't you go to the one I think is a little harder for people to understand, but why DNA assumes that there must be information, and then information must have come from somewhere. It couldn't come from nowhere.
Yeah, thank you. That in some ways is the most compelling of all. In living systems, one of the most obvious observations from the ancient Greeks to the present is that like begets like. And during the 1940s and 50s, scientists were hot on the trail to try to figure out what it was inside cells that was responsible for the transmission of hereditary traits. And part of the answer to that was revealed by Watson and Crick, who discovered the structure of the DNA molecule. They discovered that in 1953, the beautiful double helix structure. They suggested that something about the structure might allow it to contain information for transmission of hereditary traits. And then in 1957, Francis Crick got more specific, and he proposed something called the sequence hypothesis, which was just the idea that the chemical elements along the interior of the spine of the DNA molecule, the subunits known as bases, or nucleotide bases, are functioning just like alphabetic characters in a written language, or the zeros and ones in a section of software. That is to say, it's not the physical properties of these subunits that give DNA its function, but rather it's the precise arrangement of these chemical subunits in accord with an independent symbol convention later called and discovered as the genetic code. In other words, The DNA contains instruction set in an alphabetic or typographic or digital form that direct the construction of the proteins and the protein machines that keep cells alive. And that raises a huge question. We now know what the information in DNA does, and we know where it's stored, but it raises a question I call the DNA enigma. Where did the information come from? We know that it's digital in character. Bill Gates, our local hero here in the Seattle area, says that DNA is like a software program, only much more complex than any we've ever created. Richard Dawkins, the great scientific atheist at Oxford, acknowledges that DNA is like a machine code. It contains machine code. So where does information or code come from in our experience? It takes a programmer to make a program. And whenever we find information, in fact, whether it's a paragraph in a book or a software program or a hieroglyphic inscription or information transmitted across a radio signal. It always originates in a mind, and therefore the discovery of this information in these large macromolecules, as they're called, at the foundation of life, suggests the activity of a designing intelligence in the history of life.
And, Doctor, I'm going to have to cut you. This is fascinating. I hate to do this, but that we're getting the message from our producer. We have to go. So, Pete, we're finally at the Return of the God Hypothesis, Three Scientific Discoveries Revealing the Mind by Stephen Meyer. Real quick, where can people get your book?
Thanks for asking. Amazon or Barnes & Noble or any of the online sellers like Books A Million or Indie Books. And I have a website, returnofthegodhypothesis.com. And from that website, you can navigate to an author page, to the web pages for the other books I've written, and to a YouTube channel with debates that I've done and animations of what's going on inside the cell. So it's a place to take a deep dive if you're at all interested in this content.
Oh,
yeah.
Oh, we'd love to. All right. Thank you for your time. You've been wonderful. All our guests or our listeners are typing in our chat section. They love you too. So thank you very much for your time and your efforts, sir.
Thanks for having me on and for all you guys do. I really appreciate it.
All right, thank you.
Care.
All right, hey, let everybody know we're going to have to wrap it up quick here. Yep. Thank you to the folks at BBS. Check everything out, as always, chuckandjulie.com. We'll see you on Party
come
Five.
Come out to the press conference, so yep. we'll buy you a drink afterwards.
All right.